The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Great to be back with you at the start of another busy week. Made full use of the extra hour that we have now. Our clocks are in sync with America, so that's great. Of course, we've got lots of election news coming up. The big day for the United States, that's tomorrow, and we'll talk some about the momentum, the energy boosting the Trump campaign. And also, I'd like to revisit the story that we touched on Friday, Glenn Greenwald's resignation from The Intercept, and just tie that into some of the writings of my father. That's coming up at the end of the show, so hopefully we'll have enough time for that. If not, it might be pushed into tomorrow. But I'd like to set the stage for some of the news that we'll talk about here today by just reminding you of a prophecy in 2 Kings 14, verses 26 and 27. And many of you listeners are very, very familiar with these two verses. It says here, "For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel, that it was very bitter, for there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel. And the Eternal said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them. He saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash." So if you look into some of the history here, anciently Israel could have easily gone into captivity during the reign of Jeroboam II. But instead of sending the people of Israel into captivity, as we just read there, God used Jeroboam, the hand of Jeroboam, to save his people. And as we've said before, my father has written, this just demonstrates how merciful and loving God is to extend that mercy to a people that really didn't deserve it because there were no signs of repentance. But what I want to emphasize here, and this is in verse 26, is that it says there was no helper for Israel. There was nobody to help Israel. Looking at some of the commentaries on that part of the verse, one of them says they were in the most forlorn and helpless condition. Another one writes, the expression means that there was no one, great or small, young or old, to whom they could look to for aid. They just didn't have any options anywhere that you looked. And then what did God say that he did? He saved them by the hand of Jeroboam. God did it. God did it when they didn't have anyone else to help them. And of course, by doing it through this particular individual, the people really did start to look to him, the man, and then they became complacent and so on. Those are some of the things that my father's written before on our writings about the Jeroboam resurgence anciently. And of course, when you look at what's happening today in the United States, and before we get to the U.S., just look around the world and see what's happening. As I said last week, all of these powerful Western nations in Europe heading into lockdown 2.0, and what world leader in the West, what world leader is standing against it? He is standing alone. And I don't need to play for you all of the clips from the rallies. He's doing 5 a day, by the way. I think he's got 14 rallies in a 3-day span, counting Saturday, yesterday, and then today. 14 rallies. And in all of them, he's saying there's not going to be another lockdown. Here in the UK, you see Boris Johnson. He made the announcement Saturday evening that the UK goes into another lockdown. I guess it's this Thursday, this time around. At least he'll leave the schools open. It's not quite as strict as the first one. But still, another lockdown. You almost wish he would have just waited for a few days. He's probably thinking like so many in Europe. Well, surely Joe Biden's going to get in there. And Joe Biden, he's pro-lockdown too. So we just all have to go into lockdown. We got to follow along with the herd. Forget about herd immunity. Just follow the herd off the cliff. Let's just go the way of the other leaders. If Macron starts it, well, we've just got to do it, as I said last week. The evidence doesn't back it up, not at all. In fact, we're making the same disastrous mistakes this time around that we made back in March. Here in the UK, they're showing models now and graphs, all the images, all the special effects, showing that we could be hitting 4,000 deaths per day, maybe even as high as 6,000. That's what's coming in this second wave. So say the models. Haven't we heard this before? Haven't we heard this before? Even at its worst, what was the UK at? About 1,000 deaths per day going back to March, April. 1,000. Now 4,000. Okay. 4,000 to 6,000? I think at its peak in the U.S. it was 2,500. But hey, we're going into lockdown, and it's going to be at least for 4 weeks. And already you have members of Boris Johnson's government coming out and saying, you know, we've got to get ready because it could go even beyond that 4 weeks. Here's Michael Gove over, I think this was yesterday, clip one.
But if the data on the whole is not looking as you were hoping, then the national lockdown could be extended.
We will always take a decision in the national interest based on evidence. The best information we have...
Is that yes?
Yes.
So it could be extended?
Yes.
Yes, he said twice. It could be extended. Now, this time around, as Richard noted in his news gathering this morning, there's quite a lot of commentary that's dead set against this. In March, everybody, the media, of course, they were all in on it. They were all together with the government. And then even many in the nation just went along. Everybody was terrified. We were frightened into inaction. And this time around, it's a little bit different. The Daily Mail, the Telegraph, they're very much against it, writing some strong warning. You look at the headline in the Daily Mail this morning, a nightmare without end. A nightmare. When will this end? Fears grow that strict curbs could last for months. That's on the headline. That's on the front page of the Daily Mail this morning. And of course, Boris Johnson, he's catching a lot of flack as well over at Breitbart. This is in the States, but it says, cowardly and incompetent, Boris Johnson faces calls to resign after lockdown announcement. So it is a little bit different this time around. At least there's some resistance to it. Nigel Farage, he launched a new political party over the weekend, the Reform UK. And this is a party that's anti-lockdown and anti-deep state. I played for you those clips last week where he was off with President Trump in Arizona. There's not too many, though. You look around, of course, Farage isn't in power. But you look around, and aside from the populace in the United States, as far as world leaders go, the media, the opposition party, academia, popular culture, Hollywood, standing alone. There was the October issue of Imprimis came out. This is the publication put out by Hillsdale. It's got this great piece in there. I guess it's based on a lecture, actually, that he gave. He's a professor of medicine at Stanford. Jay Badakaria, I probably mispronounced it. In any event, he's a smart man. He's at Stanford. And he takes a different view on COVID-19 and the lockdown. And it's just a short, succinct piece, and yet so informative. And that's what we need in times like this, is the truth. Okay, if we're going to follow the science, then what is the science? This is from his speech It says the majority of people who are infected by COVID have very mild symptoms or no symptoms at all. These people weren't identified in the early days, which resulted in a highly misleading fatality rate. So early on, there weren't all these tests, and so the only ones that we knew that were infected were the ones that were really sick and coming into the hospitals. And so you had the WHO and other organizations saying, well, the fatality rate here is 3 to 4%. I think the WHO said 3.4%. And since that time, of course, the fatality rates have just, they've just plummeted. And this doctor from Stanford explains why. It says, though, that is what drove public policy in the beginning. These frightening mortality rates. You mean 4 out of every 100 that get sick are going to die? It says even worse, it continues to sow the sow fear and panic because the perception of too many people about COVID is frozen in the misleading data from March. See, that's what I got into last week with you. It's like we're frozen in time. We're frozen in March. And we haven't learned a thing from the 6 months since. We know so much more about the disease. We know so much more about who's vulnerable. He conducted this study in the county that he's in from Northern California and found that the death rate or the mortality rate is 0.2%. Now, that's a big difference from 3.4. He says 0.2. And when he came out with the results of his study, well, you can imagine the way the scientific community responded and the media, the Democrat media complex. They said, no way. No way. We're not going to take a contrarian view here. So they just want to blot that out. You can't hear from that doctor. He explains in his lecture that since that time, there have been something like 82 studies similar to his. And across the board, the average, the mean is 0.2%. That's the mortality rate. Now, he said from community to community, it varies a little bit. In New York, it was 0.5. Quite a few people died in New York. In Idaho, it's less than 0.2. It's 0.13. But as he explained in his lecture, this variation just shows that, well, it's basically explained by the fact that if you have bad policy, like they did in New York, let's send the sick people into the elderly homes, or if you just don't have that good of quality of health care. So that's why it will vary from place to place. But now, like the president keeps explaining, we have a better handle on the disease and hospitals are better prepared to handle it. Knowing that most of the people that get this, they have mild symptoms or they don't even know that they have it. That's what we now know, 6-7 months on. This doctor, this Stanford doctor, he says the single most important fact about the COVID pandemic in terms of deciding how to respond to it on both an individual and a governmental basis is that it is not equally dangerous for everybody. This became clear very early on, but for some reason, our public health messaging failed to get this fact out to the public. Why? When you have so many mouthpieces, why, when you have such a powerful, powerful media, can't this message get out? Well, the answer is they don't want it to get out. It's like I said last week, they've got to have everything carefully framed. They've already established the narrative. And if anyone comes along and says, no, it's actually this, well, you can't even work your way into the conversation. It says, it still seems to be a common perception that COVID is equally dangerous to everybody, but this couldn't be further from the truth. And so you know, the vulnerable ones, they're older, and they've got comorbidities, etc. For young people, there's no danger, virtually no danger at all. Same with athletes that you see on television, still playing, of course, with no fans in the stand. But they're not in danger. Listen to Bill Maher. I mean, you can't get more to the left wing than the comedian Bill Maher. He was on another talk show last week, and he said this, clip 2.
My beef with the medical establishment in this country is that they are cowards. They never would say to people that the best way to fight this, no, I'm wear masks and do whatever we have to do externally, but the best way to fight something like this is internally, to improve your immune system. One reason why this country has suffered so badly compared to other countries is because we were not in good health to begin with. We're not in good metabolic health. And if you are, I've never been afraid of this virus. I don't want to get it. No one likes to get sick. Dying is not popular either. But couldn't kill Chris Christie.
Okay, so he takes a jab there at Chris Christie, who's heavyset there at the last. But it does make the point that even those who are the most vulnerable, they still have a pretty good chance of surviving. I think the fatality rate for people over 70 is 4%. So if you're over 70 and you get COVID-19 like Donald Trump did, you have a 96% chance of surviving. Now, I think some 70-year-olds would say, you know, that's pretty good. That's pretty good odds. I'll take those chances and carry on with my life and go outside and visit the grandkids. The average age of COVID deaths here in the UK, it's 82 years of age. That's even beyond the life expectancy of just ordinary people. And yet everything in the UK, it's got to shut down for 4 weeks, maybe more, maybe more. Here's Bill Maher, clip 3.
But my way to handle this, the best way to handle it, is get yourself in better internal shape, because there are pathogens that would scare the heart out of me. This is not that one. I don't want to get it. I don't want anyone else to get it. But we should have targeted better to protect the vulnerable and let the people who are not likely to get it lead a more normal life.
Okay, that's Bill Maher saying what you heard us say over and again back in those March programs. You know, if it's a wake-up call, let the lesson be this. Let's do more to get ourselves into better internal shape. Some words of wisdom from an unexpected source. I think the very next statement after that, by the way, he goes on to say that Donald Trump's going to get crushed in the election, and then he's not going to leave the White House. So, I mean, it's real cuckoo stuff. But on that point, it's spot on. It's spot on. For young children, like this doctor from Stanford brought out in his lecture, this disease, COVID-19, it's actually less dangerous than the seasonal flu. Now, why won't you hear that? Why won't the media discuss that? Why won't they bring this up? He says that for children, they're 2 or 3 times more likely to die of the seasonal flu than from COVID-19. So you can see why there was a report last week that more and more young people are getting interested in voting for Donald Trump because they're tired of lockdown. Lockdown fatigue has set in. He starts peeling away some from the youth bloc. And of course, there's those reports that he's gaining popularity among Latinos and African Americans. Well, I'll get to that in just a second. But coming back to some of these percentages, Sam and I were crunching some numbers from the 2016 election, the one just 4 years ago, and the stats. This is science. This is some of my statistics, I guess you could say. But you're 3 times more likely to have voted for McMullen and Finn in 2016. Than to have died of COVID in 2020, which begs the question, who is McMullen and Finn? And the answer is, I have no idea. They came in fifth, we now know. They came in fifth in the 2016 presidential race. You had Hillary Clinton, she got the popular vote barely by a few million. I think it was 66 million votes that she got, 48% of the electorate. Donald Trump got 63 million, 46%. And then you have Finn and McMullen down in fifth place. And they brought in 732,000 votes. That's 0.54% of the citizenry. 0.54% of the American electorate. That's how much they brought in. And that's nearly three times larger, that percentage, than the COVID-19 fatality rate. So more than three times as many people voted for Finn McMillan. Or is it McMillan Finn? Do we know? I don't want to do the Biden-Harris or Harris-Biden mistake. But one of those two was running for president, and then the other one was the running mate. And 732,000 Americans voted for McMillan Finn. Three times as many people as have died from COVID-19. It's kind of an odd comparison, but it gives you, I think, a pretty good idea of just how rare it is, even across the board, but among young people in particular, or middle-aged people, or healthy people. You have Bill Maher there saying, I'm not worried about this. I'm not afraid of this. And yet, what do the media tell you constantly? Be afraid. Be very afraid. For all of this, we come into, in the UK now, another indefinite lockdown. And it's like this Stanford doctor brings out in his lecture. I mean, this is an unprecedented reaction or response to a virus, to the flu. It's never been done. Never. This is from his lecture. It says, the initial rationale for lockdowns was that slowing the spread of the disease would prevent hospitals from being overwhelmed. Hospitals, as it now turns out, were never at risk of being overwhelmed. See, these are some of the lessons that we should have learned, right? They weren't overwhelmed, and yet the lockdowns remained in place. The lockdowns stayed in place. He paraphrases in his lecture this UN study that estimates that 130 million people worldwide will starve this year as a result of the economic damage that this has caused around the world. All of these lockdowns, tens of millions of people, certainly not probably on your street or in your neighborhood, but tens of millions of people. Here in the UK, I mean, the UK just keeps going deeper and deeper into debt to pay people that are furloughed. And they're going to extend that through to November. Just killing itself, its economy. But then what about those in poorer countries that rely upon the stronger economies of the West to sort of pull everyone collectively out of poverty, or at least a little bit above poverty? Now we're talking about tens of millions of people dying? Not because of COVID, because of lockdown. The Stanford professor says, we know the people who are vulnerable, and we know the people who are not vulnerable. To continue to act as if we do not know these things makes no sense. We're at a place where our civilization is at risk, where the bonds that unite us are at risk of being torn. We shouldn't be afraid. We should respond to the COVID virus rationally, protect the vulnerable, treat the people who get infected compassionately, develop a vaccine, and while doing these things, we should bring back the civilization that we had so that the cure, where have you heard this before? So that the cure does not end up being worse than the disease. Tomorrow's news today. That's thetrumpet.com. This is President Trump yesterday at one of his rallies, clip 6.
Biden will imprison your people, your families in your house while letting rioters roam free and loot your streets and loot your store. Under Biden, there will be no school, no graduations, no weddings, no Thanksgiving, no Christmas, no Easter, no 4th of July. There will be no future for our country.
Biden will lock you down, put you into the house, and then let the rioters roam free. And that's what's happened. They did it all summer. I thought this piece from Politico, just to show you what, again, the president has to stand against every day, really and truly standing alone, from Politico. It says, President Donald Trump's campaign rallies between June and September may have caused some 30,000 coronavirus infections and more than 700 deaths, according to a new study by Stanford University economists. The same university that this doctor I'm quoting from goes to. I don't imagine they've really received his study on COVID-19 very well. They probably haven't received it with open arms. But here's some others saying, you know what, they're not studying how many viruses were spread because of the rioting or the World Series celebration or that Dodger player who was out hugging all of his family and friends. He was positive. How many people did he kill? How many people will he kill? But now the new study from Stanford, President Trump, by having the rallies, has killed 700 Americans. Can you believe it? You would never see a study such as this for any organization, for any group, for any rally, for any protest, for any riot, nothing. It's reserved only for a Donald Trump rally. Here's a bit more of what he said yesterday. Clip 5.
But you know what? We've gone through a lot. We've gone through a lot. The whole world has gone through a lot. For what? For what? Why have we done it? So I'm delivering the great American comeback, and we're not having any lockdowns, okay? That I can tell you. There's no lockdown.
No lockdowns, and judging by the reaction, that seems to be a fairly popular message as he campaigns from city to city. They started chanting in I believe it was Florida, "Fire Fauci, fire Fauci." And the president said, "Well, I'll let you in on a little secret. Let's just wait until after the election to decide on that." This is a man, Dr. Fauci, that, as I covered a few months ago, for a time there, he was the most powerful man in America. And now you have the president, whether he's joking or not, I guess it's not clear, but now you have the president saying, after this election, I might just get rid of him. He really is going up against the experts. And as I say, the Democrat media complex, all the leaders in Europe, there's no help, no support. He's just going directly straight to the American people. And we find out tomorrow or whenever it gets resolved in the courts, whether or not that's a message that really and truly does resonate. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Well, one thing they're no longer talking about in the media is a Biden landslide. They're still, and you could tell they're nervous. They're getting a little bit nervous as we get closer and the president bounces around to all of these Rust Belt states in Florida. Here he is, peaking right at the perfect time. There's no help from anywhere else. But you know about that prophecy in 2 Kings 14. And here we are the day before, and all the momentum, all the energy, and the energy, you could do an entire program on that alone. 1 month ago today, the president of the United States was airlifted on Marine One from off White House grounds over to Walter Reed Hospital, and was for a short time he was on oxygen. He tested positive for COVID-19, and of course, all through that weekend, you remember it well, the press, they were hyperventilating. This is it. He's vulnerable. If anyone's going to die from this, it's going to be a 74-year-old man that we hate, by the way, who's obese. He's overweight. So this was, I mean, this was a storybook ending as far as they were concerned. He downplayed the virus. And then you talk about poetic justice. He downplayed the virus, and then the virus killed him. And here we are 1 month later. I got up this morning at 5 a.m., flipped on the computer, and there's a live feed from Florida. It's midnight in Florida, and the president had just arrived there for his fifth rally. And, of course, it's in the middle of the night, and as you would expect, thousands upon thousands of supporters, and the president looking as fresh as ever. Five rallies in one day. He covered something like 3,000 miles yesterday for those five events. I think Joe Biden covered 30 miles for two events in Pennsylvania. I loved how ABC reported on the president's travels and activities through the weekend. Here's clip seven.
George, the president is in an all-out sprint to Election Day. Look where he is just today. Rallies in Michigan, Iowa, North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. Tomorrow, another five rallies in four different states. The last one in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That's where he had his last rally in 2016. For a guy who was literally in the hospital with COVID-19 on oxygen, this is really something of a marvel. And there's even talk, George, that he may do one last rally on Election Day itself. He pulled off a massive upset victory 4 years ago. He is doing everything that he can physically do to do it again, although this would be a bigger upset than 4 years ago.
These huge rallies in the face of warnings from public health officials.
Yeah, no doubt. And because of those warnings, these rallies are outdoors. So he is drawing people by the thousands, going to rallies, in some cases, bone-chilling temperatures, facing the very real threat of getting infected with coronavirus. It's really a reflection of how deep his support is, how fervent his support is. Yesterday in Pennsylvania, think about it, Pennsylvania, four different rallies, all packed. And George, at some of these rallies, really at most of them now, they actually start chanting, "We love you," to the president.
Wow, they actually start chanting, "We love you." The deep, fervent support for this man. And Biden is predicted to win by a landslide. The polls, what was the one in Wisconsin? 17 points out in front. A lot of the national polls, 8 to 10% coming into the last week. I think the Drudge headline on Friday said that, well, the president's, he's already contemplating the loss. It's over. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette came out with its endorsement of Donald Trump. It's the first time they've endorsed a Republican candidate since 1972. This is the news. This is one of the big newspapers in Pennsylvania, of all states. And this is from the Gazette. "We share the embarrassment of millions of Americans who are disturbed by the president's unpresidential manners and character, but he gets things done." This is the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. We are ashamed of this president. We share the embarrassment of millions. He's got horrible character and unpresidential manners. We're going to go ahead and endorse him, though. He does get things done. That's one of the biggest papers in Pennsylvania. Here's CNN over the weekend talking about the enthusiasm of voters in Michigan. Clip 8.
The enthusiasm on the voting side seems to be alive and well here in Michigan. Obviously, this is part of a final push by the Trump campaign to campaign in this state that they won by less than a percentage point going back to the 2016 presidential election.
He won it in 2016. This year, the polls say he has no chance at Michigan, no chance at Wisconsin. He's behind in Florida. He's behind in Arizona. He's certainly going to lose Pennsylvania. And on it goes. There was one bellwether poll from Iowa that actually did predict a victory in 2016. They had the president out in front, I think, by 6 or 7 points. Over the weekend, they came out with the same numbers. That turned out to be a sign of what was to happen just a few days later along the Rust Belt states. That's from Iowa. This is from the New York Times this morning. It says, as the national early vote climbs past a staggering 93 million and challenges to the electoral process intensify across states, President Trump and Joe Biden are barreling into Pennsylvania and turning it into a top battleground in Tuesday's election, with Democrats flooding in with door knockers and Republicans trying to parlay Mr. Trump's rallies into big turnout once again. So it's all coming. This is the New York Times this morning. It's all coming down to Pennsylvania. It was just 6-7 days ago when the New York Times says, you know what? Biden has the luxury of being able to kick his feet up and just kind of pick and choose. He doesn't need to go campaign. He's got it in the bag. And those few areas, it's really revealing. Even the states that he campaigns, he's going into Georgia. And Georgia's bright red. So he's kind of sitting back. He's looking at states that he can pick off from Trump territory. And now what's he been doing? Well, it's like he's following President Trump around through Pennsylvania, Michigan, even Minnesota. I'll get to that in just a second. But back to Pennsylvania. This is from the Epoch Times. This morning it says, Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, a Democrat, says he hasn't seen anything like President Donald Trump's rallies and barnstorming across Pennsylvania. That's the Lieutenant Governor, a Democrat. I haven't seen anything like this. Just have not seen anything like it. These are the optics. It says Donald Trump is doing things that have never been done in Pennsylvania politics in terms of the raw barnstorming across small county Pennsylvania. It says it's hard to predict with certainty how that's going to activate not only his base of voters from 2016, but also those that sat it out too. It's hard to predict. Of course, you can't ever predict these things, but you can certainly observe what's happening on the ground, and there is a lot happening on the ground. The CBS had a tweet earlier about the possible Republican surge scenario. So you can see that they're already beginning to backtrack a little bit. They want to be able to come out and say, well, all right, we might have gotten it a little bit wrong, but it wasn't spectacularly wrong. Switching back to the New York Times, it says both campaigns see Pennsylvania as increasingly crucial to victory. Mr. Trump now appears more competitive here than in Michigan and Wisconsin, two other key northern states he hopes to win. And Mr. Biden's clearest electoral path to the White House runs through the state, Pennsylvania, that is. And it says Pennsylvania has 20 electoral votes and so on. So it may well come down to Pennsylvania. Some would tell you that without Pennsylvania, there's no way that the president can win, but boy, you look at the electoral votes that he got in 2016, you subtract Pennsylvania from that, he still wins. So there are different paths. But I would think that for Joe Biden's camp, if they don't get Pennsylvania, that's it. It's going to be a long night. It's going to be and of course, that's where they're lining up the lawyers, because they want to litigate this. This is where they've got, you know, the lieutenant governor's Democrat, the governor's Democrat, so they've got help. They've got help in the state government there to allow for these ballots to come pouring in days after the election. So we'll soon see if it's going to be pretty obvious tomorrow night, or if the thing's going to drag on. But with respect to Minnesota, the president visited Minnesota on Friday night, And here again, they've got left-wing leaders at the top there in that state. And so because they used COVID-19 as an excuse to basically try to nuke his rally. They told the president's handlers that you can only have 250 people. And the president explained that they probably thought I would just cancel it then, but he didn't. He went ahead and went. And the images coming from that, all of the people that lined up outside just to get a glimpse of the president going into the rally, this little Biden-like rally. Well, for Biden, 250 would probably be huge. As someone said recently, he'd have trouble filling up a minivan. 250 people. They narrow it down to 250, and then you've got thousands of people lining up, cheering them on. And this is what the president went out after he talked, or before, I forget which. He went out to acknowledge the overflow crowds of thousands. This is in Minnesota. Minnesota last voted for a Republican presidential candidate in 1972. It's been almost 50 years. Ronald Reagan didn't even win it in 1984. That was the one state he didn't pick up. So you've got to go back to 1972 and Richard Nixon. That's the last time Minnesota voted Republican. And listen to what President Trump said outside that Minnesota rally on Friday, clip 10.
There are thousands of people, look over there, thousands of people, all because the governor wants to play games. The governor wants to play games. He's a weak governor. He's done a terrible job. You got 25,000 people. It's a disgrace. So we're going to go back and speak to 250 people. But I wanted to say hello to some of the people that came. You have cars that are 3 miles long. It's a shame what the governor did. And that's why they're going to lose Minnesota, just like he did with Minneapolis, where they didn't know what they were doing. They're going to lose Minnesota. We're going to win Minnesota.
Now, again, maybe he's going to be wrong, but this is a president who's speaking with some boldness and confidence here in these last few days. What does he know? He's been joking a lot. He joked about Melania. He said that the two of them, you know, got COVID at the same time, which only proves that she has in fact been living with him in the White House. You know, all the conspiracy theories that she must be in Northern Virginia somewhere. He's out there making all these jokes. And then speaking confidently, we're going to take Minnesota as well. And then, of course, when you look at the thousands of people showing up, Minnesota is going to be an interesting story, an interesting storyline on election night. We'll see. There's going to be several states, obviously, that are critical. But he's speaking with confidence. He's throwing a joke out here and there, and then, of course, he's really going hard after his opponent as well. Here's clip 11.
For decades, Joe Biden let other countries rip you off, rip off our country, and cheat America blind. And there was a group, they would let him do anything. Biden has been there for 5 decades, and the only people who benefited from his policies were himself and his family, frankly.
Right, they just raked it in for 47 years, and in particular when he was vice president, just going into some of those Hunter Biden revelations. There was a tweet, I think last week, with all, he came into politics in 1973, Mr. Biden did, and that's the tweet basically had every year listed out in a column, 1973 all the way through to 2020. 73, it said, you know, Joe Biden enters into politics. Every single other year was blank. And then you get down to 2020, Joe Biden says, you know, I'll fix America. In other words, what has he done for, and the president keeps pointing this out, look, you've been there for almost a half century. You've been there almost 50 years. So as I say, he's got quite a lot of ammunition, the president does. And here's the candidate, the challenger, Joe Biden, yesterday, talking about all the tax breaks that the president made in his first term, clip 12.
Hey, how many of you did really well with that $1.9 trillion tax cut that increased? Really in good shape, right? Really changed your, well, you did. Well, that's good. I'm glad to see you're doing well already. And I'm good, but guess what? If you elect me, I'm not going to have your taxes are going to be raised, not cut.
if you elect me, your taxes are going to be a rate. Yeah. Who writes this? Maybe it's off the top of his head. Who says, vote for me, I'll raise your taxes? Who says, vote for me, Pennsylvania, I'll eliminate fracking, I'll eliminate the oil and gas industry? This is why they're scrambling in Pennsylvania. It's just been one mistake after another. And then on the whole, vote for me. I'll mandate masks for everyone and I'll lock it down. And then they've had to come out and say, no, we're not really for lockdowns. We're not really going to ban fracking. Lots of mistakes right here at the last. This is from NBC. Again, you think about a media covering their tracks. It says, Biden and his campaign are making mistakes that will ensure little of this matters, and the polls are almost certainly wrong again. This is NBC, or someone at NBC, saying that I think Trump's going to win this. Contrary to the prevailing wisdom among the Kanye Shenty, I had to look that up. This is someone who's in the know, someone who has an insider take. Contrary to the prevailing wisdom, history and current circumstances suggest President Donald Trump is going to defeat former Vice President Joe Biden for some of the very same reasons he came from behind in 2016 to shock the Democrat presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. It says, finally, it is understandable why conventional wisdom is getting this wrong again. Trump is down in the polls. The nation's demographics are continuing to change in ways unfavorable to Trump and Republicans. The coronavirus has wrought death and economic destruction throughout the land, and Trump's personality provokes stormy oceans of antipathy, perhaps most crucially, among women and suburban voters. But then you dig a little bit deeper. Again, I know the radical left makes a big deal of the suburban voters and such, but you think about all of these endorsements that he's getting endorsements from people named Lil Wayne, Ice Cube, 50 Cent. I mean, and I'm not familiar with these people, but these are people that have a large throng of followers, many of them young black men. He's making gains in the Hispanic community. He's got a good message for Pennsylvania. It's amazing to me how much the media will discount. They've pinned their hopes on the elderly and suburban women voters. It'll be an interesting next couple of days. The last thing I want to make, or point that I want to make on this, is just how many, again, going back to what you've read before in The Trumpet, is just how many articles that you're seeing now, mostly from conservative media, but articles that talk about this being the most important election ever or since 1860, and that you've got to vote for Donald Trump to save America. To save America. David Limbaugh, he had a piece at PJ Media, Vote Trump, Save America. And I thought this comment was interesting from Right Scoop over the weekend. It's in this piece they did about the radical left and how that they were doing everything they could to try to prevent President Trump from having a successful rally in Minnesota. And then it pointed out, but thousands showed up anyway, as I just noted. And it says this right at the end of the article. As tough as things are right now, as hard as the left is kicking and screaming, we are breaking their stranglehold on America. And again, just go back to that early 2018 article, Saving America by the Hand of Jeroboam, or Saving America Temporarily, from the radical left. That's 2 years ago. 2 years ago. This is from James Dellingpole at Breitbart. And how about this headline? It says, Only Donald Trump can save us from the Great Reset. Now, the Great Reset is this new world order where, you know, the ruling elites, they're the authoritarians. They know what's good for the ordinary citizens, and everybody just has to go along. And according to Dellingpole, only Donald Trump, one man, only Donald Trump can save us from this. This is just the conclusion of his article. Why are they doing this? Hashtag, why are they doing this? has become a popular hashtag on Twitter for the increasing number of people concerned at the extraordinarily draconian and often scientifically inexplicable policies being adopted by governments the world over to deal with coronavirus. This is trending. I'm sure Jack Dorsey will do everything he can to try to obscure this. But there's people out there saying, why are they doing this? How could we do this again? How could we go into lockdown 2.0? Have we learned nothing? Don't they know that the young, the healthy are not vulnerable? These are the ones that are primarily moving society forward. You heard what Bill Maher said. That's right from the radical left. Dellingpole says the Great Reset may be the answer, according to them, according to the left. And if it is the answer, and so if so many world leaders are on board, then my view is that there is only one man in the world who can save us from it. That man is Donald Trump. It says, it's why, in my view, this presidential election is probably the most important political event anyone alive will live through. On the outcome depend our liberty, our prosperity, our civilization. So I would just refer you back to what we touched on right at the start of this program, this fast-moving program, 2 Kings 14, verses 26 and 27. And I've got more in another segment that I guess I'll have to push back to tomorrow, that Glenn Greenwald resignation from The Intercept. But you think about where you heard it first, saving America, and how God brought it all about. The Trumpet, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, The Key of David. Really, this is God's work, and tens of millions of people should be tuning in, because you really and truly do get tomorrow's news today. Eventually, tens of millions will. But where else can you go for truth, for accuracy in forecasting? There may be a few details here and there that we don't always know, and there certainly are still some details that we can't fully understand or know. But God certainly does give us some precious insights. And he does that because he wants for us to proclaim this warning message to a wayward people that, look, repentance is the only way. Now, God is a merciful God. And sometimes he'll even extend mercy and intervene on our behalf positively when we don't really even deserve it. But the long-term solution, the only solution, is repentance toward God. A few emails that we can conclude with. This one here says, I just wanted to thank you for the latest article on Empire. My son is mentally handicapped, but I've been teaching him God's truth since he was old enough to understand. We watch the Trumpet Daily together, and he loves hearing you talk about things I've taught him for years. It confirms to him what I've taught him, that I've taught him the truth. In reference to the Trumpet Daily, it has become our favorite news program. We love your attitude when you editorialize, and you come across as human as opposed to the stiff commentators on other religious programs. It says your sense of humor is most entertaining. There you go, fellas. Keep that in mind. It's most entertaining, so thanks for all that you do. Here's another one. It says, just wanted to let you know what a great job you guys are doing, and I truly appreciate the work that is put into each show. As you stated last week, it sure would be nice to see some justice done towards these treasonous traitors that have been getting away with all of their law-breaking. Another one here writes, thank you for the excellent programming this week. I've learned more inspiring lessons from history by tuning into the Trumpet Daily over the last couple of years than in my high school and college experiences combined. How about that? An educational program as well. It says, please continue to courageously trumpet the truth. Another one here says, I realize that Stephen Fleury has a team to help him, but I have to say the amount of work that clearly goes into researching each daily trumpet show is truly impressive. Thank you for the Trumpet Daily radio show. And then one more here, it says, I found the program about Lincoln so fascinating that I decided to order the 6-volume books about Lincoln. I don't think I've read this one. In any event, he ordered the 6-volume set by Sandberg. It says, I almost gave up when I saw how much sellers were asking, but I did find a set at a much lower price, and they are now on their way. I regret never being interested in history. Thank you for perking my interest. I have a lot to learn and probably not a lot of time to catch up because I just turned 80 with too much wasted time behind me. An 80-year-old who just ordered the 6-volume set so that he can further his education. Well, that's all we have time for on today's show. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit some feedback, email us, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.